I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. An uneasy calm seems to have settled over the battleground Iraqi city of Najaf, but it is still impossible to say who, if anyone, has won the battle. The radical Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is said by some of his aides to have been injured in the fighting. He has told his followers that he's prepared to be martyred for their cause. Some critics of this week's action say that it risks widening the anti-US campaign in Iraq, that the country's Shia, who form the majority of the population, could join the minority Sunni in attacking US forces if al-Sadr is killed or captured, or if Najaf's revered Shia shrine is damaged in the fighting. We're going to be discussing the situation in Iraq this hour with a number of guests. We'd like to hear from you as well. What is it that makes this young, controversial cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, such a key figure? Why are the Americans and the interim government in Baghdad so determined that he must be crushed? And where is the senior Shia cleric, Ali al-Sistani, while all this is happening? Does he bear some responsibility to help end the standoff and secure a peace? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, I'm joined first on the line from Baghdad by Scott Baldauf. He's the Christian Science Monitor's correspondent there. Scott, can you just bring us up to date the information you've got about what kind of a day it's been today in Najaf?
Well, here in Baghdad, we have a very quiet day. There was a large protest outside of the Green Zone this morning. Thousands of supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr showed up and shouted chants against the American, what they view as the American occupation. The fighting seems to have eased, although when we drove through Sadr City itself, there were landmines being laid for the next round of fighting. So this is a period in which the Sadr forces are taking a breather and preparing for the next fight.
How widespread, Scott, do you assess the support for Muqtada al-Sadr to be among the Shia population, particularly there in Baghdad?
Well, in Baghdad, he is one of many Shia leaders and probably the smallest of the groupings, but his support is intense. It is a group that is willing to fight and to die for their cause, unlike the Shias who throw their support behind Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. The problem here is that Mr. Sadr represents a very poor population in Sadr City, which is a slum in the north part of town, the northeast part of town. This is a slum that has been oppressed since the beginning by the Saddam Hussein regime, and now they see the same repression happening under the new government supported by the United States. Oppression to them means there's no electricity, there's no water, there's sewage still running in the streets. They see no benefit with the new government, and in fact, they see many of their leaders shut out of the decision-making process. And so for that reason, they have taken up the fight against the Iraqi government and the American forces.
And do you think that the events of the past few days in Najaf, this really quite concerted military attempt to defeat al-Sadr on the streets of that city, has that added to his support, do you believe?
Well, the symbolism here is very crucial. You know, the Muqtada al-Sadr is wrapping himself in the cloak of a martyr. And that symbolism does work among Shias. It works because Shias from the very beginning have had a long line of martyrs. Starting from the very beginning, Ali, of course, was killed by his own followers because they thought that he was conducting a deal that was something they could not accept. Hussein, who is even in some ways more revered than Ali, was martyred in the field of battle in a place called Karbala, very close to Najaf. And from then onwards, there have been a number of ayatollahs, of sheikhs, and various religious figures who have died in defense of their cause. Shias see themselves as downtrodden, and for that reason, the imagery of what Mr. Sadr is doing in Najaf it works. It works for Shias, even if they don't agree with his politics.
Just one question, Scott, about the Prime Minister, Mr. Alawi, because, of course, he now, in theory, is the man who is directing the political strategy against al-Sadr. How important is the outcome of Najaf to him?
It's crucial, actually. At this stage, Mr. Alawi has control of Baghdad and a few other places, but, you know, the Kurdish north is a regional area that is autonomous. The Sunni triangle, which includes cities like Fallujah, Ramadi, Samarra, names that would be familiar to any American who watches CNN or, you know, listens to NPR, these are areas that are essentially abdicated now by the Iraqi government and by U.S. forces to the insurgents. Now that there's a rebellion in the south, Alawi is in a place where he has to take a stand, say U.S. experts, that he needs to be strong. And his organization, even though it is intense, is one that they feel can be defeated militarily in Najaf, and they can get the momentum going to start to roll back this rebellion. The danger here is that if there is an outcry at any damage to the shrine, if Mr. Sadr himself is killed in this fight, he could actually draw more support from Shias who will see him again as a martyr.
Scott, thanks very much indeed for that. Scott Baldauf of the Christian Science Monitor joining us from Baghdad. Let me introduce two more of our guests this hour now. Amatsia Baram has been listening to what Scott Baldauf has been telling us from his office in Washington, D.C., where he's a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He's also professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Haifa in Israel. Juan Cole teaches modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's the author most recently of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture and History of Shiite Islam. He joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thanks to you both for joining us. Welcome to The Connection. Amatsia Baram, is there some kind of end game being played out in Najaf, do you believe?
I see basically two different options for the American forces and for the Iraqi government. One is to have full control over the rest of Najaf except for the shrine, Ali's shrine, and just besiege the shrine and wait for Muqtada Sadr to give up, even without negotiations, just surrender. That will require a lot of patience, a lot of time, and some casualties. Another possibility is to do the same, but not to wait very much after Najaf is effectively in American hands, except for the Holy Shrine, and then start a negotiating process with Muqtada. I don't think Muqtada Sadr really wants to be a martyr. I think he'll help the Americans to avoid martyring him. The whole charade of it's really an interesting charade to wrap himself in shrouds. But people, at the most Shiites, see through it. Some don't. Some admire him and will go all the way. But the majority, I think, see through the whole thing. And they know Muqtada Sadr does not want to die in any way. Otherwise, he would be hiding in the holiest shrine for Shiites in the world. So, except maybe for Mecca. So, I think Sistani already from London suggested negotiations. So I suppose negotiations is an open option.
There are reports that negotiations are already underway. Juan Cole, Muqtada al-Sadr, obviously he wants the Americans out of Najaf. He wants the Americans out of Iraq. Does he want more than that?
Well, in the long term, I think he wants a Iran-style government in Iraq, ruled by the Shiite clergy, ultimately as he aged and became more senior, I think he would like to be the supreme jurisprudent in Iraq, that is to say, a figure like Iran's Ali Khamenei. But let me just say that I don't think that he would be lying there wounded in the shrine of Imam Ali if he, in fact, weren't ready to die. And I think you have to understand that this is a person whose family history has seen a great deal of brutality. His father and two older brothers were mown down by machine gun fire by Saddam's forces. His father-in-law, Mohammed Bakr al-Sadr, was executed by Saddam in 1980. And I see every indication that Muqtada Sadr is perfectly prepared to accept his own death. I think it's a good sign that we hear that there may be negotiations going on. But we've seen these periods of retrenchment and negotiation before in the past year. Muqtada has always backed off for a little bit and then come back strong. So I don't think that this is somebody who, if he lives and remains at large, is going to compromise for very long.
Amatsia Baram, let me just ask you this, because I think it's a question on many people's minds. Why has all this come to a head now? There obviously were clashes some months ago. There was some kind of negotiated settlement then. There's been a period of relative calm. Suddenly, now we see this huge increase in the level of the violence. Why now?
Yes. Well, first of all, again, Juan and me have a difference of opinion on Muqtada's goal. I think, actually, I agree with Juan. His goal is to be like Khomeini in Iran, the chief marja, and in Iran they call it Rahbar, the great leader, and just like Khomeini or Khamenei today. So a guy like that does not want to die, does not intend on being a martyr. And I agree with him, again with Juan, that his father and his great uncle died, and they knew they would be killed. The difference is that they knew they would be killed, because under Saddam, when you said something against Saddam, you are dead. He knows with the Americans it's different. So I think it's a different story. But in any case, that's a matter of interpretation.
Okay.
The reason for the recent upsurge of violence is in dispute. He says that the Americans changed the rules of the game. The Americans, at least what I saw, seems to me to be actually more reliable, that he was trying to take a police station and just extend his control area in Najaf. And, of course, the government cannot allow that. And in any case, perhaps the most important thing, he has now a state within a state. He has his own Shari courts. He has his own judges, Qudat, who are actually very young and inexperienced. They issue orders, and his Mahdi army is carrying out the order. So this is a state within a state. Long term, the government cannot accept it. But it seems to me that this particular case, as far as I understand, he was the one who tried to, again, rise and shine, because he felt either that both things, he was being neglected, he didn't get what he wanted in terms of representation in the Iraqi Congress, which he's supposed to be convened soon, and he felt that he was being forgotten, and now is the time to do it again, hoping to get more.
Amatsia Baram, thanks for that. Thanks for joining us for this segment of the program. Amatsia Baram is a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, also professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Haifa in Israel. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, your thoughts on why what is happening in Najaf is happening, what its implications are, who is and why is he so important, Muqtada al-Sadr. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection on NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're following latest developments in Iraq, specifically in Najaf, this hour. Still with us, Professor Juan Cole, Professor of Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. We're also joined now for the rest of this hour by Nir Rosen, who's a freelance journalist. He spent the past year in Iraq, left in June, and he wrote about the Sunni opposition there in the July 5th edition of The New Yorker. Nir, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us. There are many differences between the Sunni insurgency, the kind of thing, for example, that's been seen in Fallujah and elsewhere in the so-called Sunni Triangle, and what we're seeing now in Najaf. Can you take us through a little bit what you perceive some of those differences to be?
Well, the Sunnis are more united to begin with. They feel a sense of threat because they realize they have lost the country in a way, or they're losing the country to what they see as these Shia hordes. They often refer to the Shia as in a way that we would view as racist over here, as less sophisticated. They view them as foreigners because this is a minority that ruled the country for all of its existence. And they're terrified of the Shias. But I think what's more interesting is that they've managed to postpone the eventual battle over control of the country and unite with the Shias to fight the Americans. This is one of the great American failures, is that they managed to actually, or perhaps a success, unite Sunnis and Shias for the first time against a common enemy. And you often hear Sunnis in Fallujah praising Muqtada Sadr as the only Shia they admire and denigrating Sistani for compromising with the Americans. And another difference, though, is that Sunnis often have a lot more military leadership among their ranks in the resistance, whereas the Shias tend to be led purely by clerics.
Juan, let me just get your thoughts on whether what's happening now in Najaf, the violence of the past week or so, the negotiations which are said to be underway now, is this a crucial moment in Iraq's post-war history? Is it simply another skirmish, another battle, one in a long series? There will be many more to come.
Oh, there are going to be more battles. It seems to me that Muqtada Sadr is easy to underestimate. Nir has interviewed him. He speaks this rough gutter Arabic, and he's kind of a hothead. And he's young, and so people, even among the Shiite clerical hierarchy, tend to dismiss him. But what he did was to map out a strategy for occupying the most important symbolic and sacred space in Iraq, that is to say, the city of Najaf, and then ensconce his fighters there. One of the reasons we're having this fighting now is that in late May and early June, a truce was reached, the premise of which was that Muqtada would disarm his fighters and send them out of the city. They're not actually from Najaf. And he said he would do so, and then he did not, and then he seemed to be strengthening his positions instead. There were also, I think, attempts by the Marines to arrest him, which also contravenes the truce from the other side, so that he understood that Najaf is a key battleground. If you hold it, you hold a place that gets enormous amounts of money from the pilgrim trade, and holding it is a source of prestige and esteem. And attempting to dislodge him from it risks being seen as a form of desecration. So the Alawi government, in deciding to allow the Marines to fight in Najaf, to bomb the sacred cemetery of the Valley of Peace, which has 2 million graves built up over centuries of people bringing their loved ones there to be near the shrine of Imam Ali. All of this, I think, reflects very badly on the Alawi government and on the Americans in the minds of not only Iraqi Shiites, but Shiites throughout the world, and not only Shiites, but Muslims throughout the world. I saw a man on the street interviews today on Arab cable television, and people were universally dismayed and saw this as an attack on Islam.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Mark called that number. He's in Manteo, North Carolina. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great show. Wanted the panelists to answer whether they think there's direct Iranian support for Muqtada al-Sadr and why the more moderate Shia clerics haven't been more vocal in speaking out against him. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that, Mark. Juan, do you think there is direct Iranian support for Muqtada?
No, the Iranians are very afraid of Muqtada Sadr, the Iranian clerical hierarchy. They tend to support Sistani and to see him as sort of one of their own, one of the club. Muqtada doesn't have credentials. He's 30. He's viewed by them kind of like a graduate student. And moreover, his movement is based in the slums of the cities of the south. It's very nativist. They often speak against Iranian influence on Iraqi Shiism. There are some Iranian pilgrims and volunteers who've slipped across the border to join the fighting on Muqtada's side. I don't believe, on the whole and by and large, these are people who are getting Iranian government support. Iran may have given Muqtada some money or supplies at one point or another, but then the Iranians seem to be giving everybody money and supplies. They're developing constituencies among all the major Shiite politicians, including a secular figure like Ahmad Chalabi. So I don't see this this movement as highly involved in with Iran. In fact, ironically, the group that is closest to Iran in Iraq is the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was based in Tehran for over 20 years and which is right now in alliance with the Americans. So the most pro-Iranian, the most the group most involved with Iran is actually on the American side at the moment.
Neil, let me get your thoughts, if I may, on how likely it is that the Muqtada phenomenon, if we can call it that, really is spreading to other towns and cities around Iraq, that the Najaf episode of the past week to 10 days could light some kind of flame which then spreads through the country.
Well, I think the flame has already been lit, and we've seen fighting throughout the country in Kut, in Nasiriyah. 2 days ago in Nasiriyah, crowds were chanting, "Oh, Alawi, you coward, you agent of the Americans," and they burned down the offices of the Prime Minister's political party. There's fighting in Baghdad. I think this flame was lit, in fact, immediately after the war in April 2003, when Muqtada capitalized upon the network of mosques and clerics that his father had established before being killed, and established government within the government, providing social services, taking over mosques, taking over hospitals. He has basically owned Shia Iraq from day one, and the Americans lost it by allowing him to fill that void of power. And the fighting will only continue throughout the country.
Okay, thanks. Steve is on the line from Colton in North Carolina. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a question, and I don't know how pertinent it is, but I was wondering if Sadr has any connection, or Sadr or any like him, with international terrorism, or is he a fighter for Iraq and being in Iraq?
Okay, so you're wondering if he has links to international extremists who may pose a threat to other countries?
Yes, or right. Terrorists such as the ones involved in the 9/11 bombing in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Juan?
Well, no, Muqtada Sadr's movement is a movement of ghetto youth gangs, really, in places like East Baghdad. They're really, I have compared them in one interview to the Crips and the Bloods. They're very indigenous to Iraq. They haven't, under the Saddam regime, of course, they had no opportunity for connecting up with other groups outside the country. They were repressed and underground. And the 9/11 hijackers, Al-Qaeda, come from a tradition that is hyper-Sunni. They're very devoted to the tenets of Sunni Islam, and on the whole and by and large, they hate and despise Shiites, and some of them have openly talked about trying to use attacks on Shiites to leverage anger against the United States and so forth. So the Muqtada phenomenon is indigenous. It's Shiite. It would be at daggers drawn with a group like Al-Qaeda.
Right. Neil, let me just get your thoughts on this. I mean, there are people in Iraq operating who are said to have links to Al-Qaeda. There's the group around Al-Zarqawi. Now, are you aware, have you seen any evidence of any links between the kind of people who support the people in Najaf, the kind of people who support al-Sadr, and others who are said to be closer to al-Qaeda?
Not at all. Nothing Iranian. I've seen no Iranian support and no interaction between the local Shia fighters. And they view themselves as fighting a war of national liberation. They're not interested in fighting America and other battlegrounds. They've even attempted to unite with Hezbollah, the Lebanese political party that has fought the Israeli occupation, and Hezbollah refused to join them. refuse to send them support, and you often hear bitterness among the ranks of the Shias in Iraq for not getting assistance from Shias around the world. So they view themselves purely as fighting a war of liberation. I don't think there's any connection between them and what you could call international terrorism. Additionally, you see very little evidence right now in Iraq of any interaction between the local fighters, Sunni or Shia, and international terrorism. Accusations have been made by the Americans, but very little evidence exists, even that Zarqawi is in Iraq or that he has a connection with al-Qaeda.
1-800-423-8255 is our number, 1-800-423-TALK. You are welcome to join our conversation. Steve is calling from Attleboro, Massachusetts. Steve, hi.
Good morning.
Thank you. Hi.
Just a quick question. I'm a bit confused. I don't understand why the Americans are the bad guys in this particular situation. Here's a bunch of al-Sadr's thugs hiding in cemeteries and mosques and hospitals and how come they're not the bad guy? How come Muslims don't rise up and repudiate these people who violate holy shrines and cemeteries by turning them into weapon storage units and battlegrounds? I don't understand.
Good question. Thank you, Steve. Juan, you have armed men in holy places, in particularly in one of the holiest of all the shrines in Shiism.
Well, it is certainly the case that there's a great deal of disapproval of this sort of thing, especially in Najaf itself and among partisans of Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. So it's not the case that Sadr movement is given a pass by everybody for its thug-like behavior. On the other hand, there are hierarchies of values. There are some things that trump other things. And when you've got a choice as an Iraqi Shiite or even just as a Muslim anywhere between supporting a Sayyid, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad who has an Islamic movement, versus Marines, American, Christian, and other infidels, who are fighting on Islamic sacred soil, well, most Muslims would choose the Muslim party in the conflict. And I don't think that's so hard to understand. I mean, after all, even though Santana in Texas was defending Mexican territory against a bunch of rogue slave traders and others, the European heritage Americans tend to identify with the defenders of the Alamo. So these kinds of loyalties and symbols produce a hierarchy of values that helps to order the world. And I don't think it's so hard to understand why most Muslims would be more angry at the Marines than they are at Sadrists.
Juan, I want to ask you about the Grand Ayatollah, about Ali Sistani, because he's out of the country at the moment. He is a major figure in Najaf. He's in London at the moment, said to be receiving medical treatment. Is that just an unfortunate coincidence of timing, or do you see some link between what's happening in Najaf and the fact that Sistani isn't there?
Well, the Arabic press in London has reported sourcing to people in Sistani's circle, but anonymous sources, that the absence of Sistani is political. I mean, I think he does genuinely have heart problems. He's got blocked arteries, and it's probably going to be treated by angioplasty. The British government is said to have known 2 weeks beforehand that he was coming, and the reports are that it was, I think, understood that there was going to be some kind of end game in Najaf, that the American-appointed governor of the city, Ali al-Zarufi, saw Sadr's militiamen taking over more and more of the city, and he felt that they simply had to be rolled back. No one believed that the Iraqi self-defense forces or police were likely actually to do that. Many often when they have been sent to fight Sadr, they have defected. And so the Marines were going to have to be brought in from a practical point of view. And so the danger was, if you gamed this out, that if Muqtada were captured or killed, it wasn't impossible that his more militant followers would then take revenge on Sistani by killing him, assassinating him. And since Sistani is such a pillar of the Iraqi establishment and stability in the country, that would be a huge disaster. It was also possible that Muqtada Sadr might attempt to take refuge in Sistani's house. And there is a custom in Islam of sanctuary or refuge, in which case Sistani would be obliged to enter into mediation efforts on Muqtada's behalf. Sistani didn't obviously want either of those eventualities to occur if there were major fighting in Najaf, and so his medical condition became a convenient way of absenting himself.
Nir, your thoughts on the role of Sistani at this time?
I think Sistani may have fled for his life. Certainly there's no coincidence between his departure and the fighting. He had often warned the Americans not to attack Najaf, and perhaps it's safer for him not to be there.
Do you think, though, that he, although he would never be able to say so, would be quietly pleased if the influence of Muqtada al-Sadr could be, if not negated, then at least severely reduced?
Yes, from the rise of Muqtada al-Sadr following the end of the war, there has been a great deal of terror and resentment among the ranks of Sistani and the more traditional moderate leaders, because they just don't have this sort of militant mass support. They view Muqtada as a threat to their very existence. His followers have physically attacked many of Sistani's followers, taken over mosques that Sistani and his supporters have controlled. This is also a financial battle, in fact, because the money that comes into the mosques and to Najaf is controlled by these very clerics, and Muqtada wants this money, wants this power that they have. I'm sure they'd be very happy if Muqtada was killed.
I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. We're looking at the latest news out of Najaf in Iraq this hour on The Connection. With me, Juan Cole, Professor of Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan, and Nir Rosen, a freelance journalist who spent the past year in Iraq. He left in June. When we come back, you can join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection. The fighting in Najaf in Iraq appears to be quelled at the moment, but the outcome of the standoff between American and Iraqi forces on the one hand and the Mahdi army of the radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr on the other has yet to be determined. Joining us this hour, Juan Cole from the University of Michigan and Nir Rosen, a freelance journalist who spent much of the past year in Iraq. On the line is Tony, calling from Nashville in Tennessee. Hi, Tony.
Good morning, Robin.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Let me just say that, firstly, I approve of the ouster of Saddam Hussein and all that he represented in terms of threats to his own nation and internationally. But this morning's discussions absolutely underscore the complexities of 5,000 years of history. And I think there's a certain Western naivety in assuming that we can, as an outside force, can alter the course of that sort of historical establishment. And as I say, the complexities of all these intricacies that your guests are speaking about today, it rather tends towards the belief that perhaps these folks are best left to their own political devices, rather than any insinuation from the outside world. I mean, surely we can lend support in terms of, you know, sustenance and other sustained sort of relief movements to the people of Iraq. But to try and infer some sort of Western civilized or, well, at least a democracy on these people is, I think, is naive at best.
Okay, Tony, thank you. Juan, just moving forward from that thought from Tony, there is now an interim government in place in Iraq under Alawi, who is himself a Shia, perhaps we should remind our listeners. Is this something which is important to him? I mean, is this, in a sense, an interim government operation, or is it still the US military who are in the driving seat?
Well, I think it's both. Alawi very much fears the movement of Muqtada Sadr. Alawi was appointed by the United Nations in close consultation with the United States and is an old CIA asset with a background as a Ba'athist hitman. Alawi's, although he is from a Shia background, it is his ex-Ba'athist identity that really is important in understanding his politics. He has brought in as interior minister a man, a Sunni from Samarra named Fala Naqib, who his family broke with Saddam and worked against Saddam, but they had been Ba'athists. And as defense minister, a Shia, a secular Shia from Al-Hilla, Hazem Ash'alan, who is also an ex-Ba'athist. And the three of them, I think, are making policy. And their hope, I think, is to rehabilitate the ex-Ba'athist, which is to say to attempt to mollify the anger and fear of the Sunni Arab community, and then to make an alliance with secular Shiites. In essence, it's a kind of policy that the early Ba'ath in the 1970s pursued before Saddam got in. Saddam, of course, was a wild man and upset all kinds of apple carts. But there is, you know, a possibility of ruling Iraq from this base of more secular Shiites and of the Sunni Arabs. And this is Alawi's program. And the things that Naqib in particular and Shalan say just remind me so much of the old Ba'ath point of view. They attack Iran for interfering in Iraqi affairs and kind of rattle sabers at Iran and Syria. They accuse Muqtada Sadr of being a foreign agent and the Shiites in Iraq of being Iranian inspired and talk about the crisis forced on the country by this foreign interference and talk about how important it is that the Arab neighbors are now supporting the government of Iraq against this indigenous or this threat from the east, that is to say the Shiites of Iran. So I think that there's every reason to believe Alawi wanted Muqtada's people defeated in Najaf. But I think he really undermined himself by sending in the Marines to do it because it makes him look like an American agent.
Let's hear from Williamsburg, Virginia. David's on the line from there. Hello, David.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is a twofold question. It deals with al-Sadr. If he is captured or killed, how do your guests think that will impact the fighting in Najaf? Would someone else just take al-Sadr's place within his organization? Or would it result in pretty much the disbanding of those fighters? And second, if he isn't killed but simply captured, has any thought been given to whether or not he would be considered an American prisoner of war, or if Iraq would go ahead and take control and custody of him, similar to what they did with Saddam?
Interesting. Yeah. Nir Rosen, do you what do you think?
Well, if he's killed, there certainly isn't a similar charismatic leader that could attract the following. But he doesn't represent merely himself. He represents the frustrations of millions of people in Iraq, and they've centered around him. But his disappearance wouldn't take away their frustrations, wouldn't take away their resentment. And this is the occupation itself. It's also their poverty, their oppression, the fact that they feel like they weren't represented by the Saddam government, nor are they represented by the current government. And the daily humiliation and oppression of an occupation. These frustrations find their focus in Muqtada and his group and his followers. So I suppose some other clerics will have to take over. I think the battle will continue perhaps even more fiercely because he'll be viewed as a third martyr in the tradition of his father and his great uncle.
Antoine, just on the legal question, who do you think would be likely to take possession of al-Sadr if he were to be captured? Would the Iraqis hold him or would the Americans?
Well, I think the Iraqis would hold him now, but I have to say that it's not a pleasant prospect because unlike Saddam, who is widely hated and reviled throughout Iraq, even by most Sunnis, I think, Muqtada has fanatical devotees, adorers throughout the country. And as long as he is in captivity, I think there will be massive demonstrations demanding his release. There will be guerrilla attempts to free him, there will be trouble. And if he's killed, the same thing. He represents a movement. Here I kind of disagree with Nir. I think that movement is capable of throwing up other leadership. His father started the movement in the 1990s. It networks. It has mosques and soup kitchens and courts throughout the country. It's not going to disappear because you kill Muqtada. And I think killing him would tip that movement into adopting the techniques of the Sunni insurgents in the Sunni heartland of continual attacks on American troops, roadside bombings, that the insurgency essentially would spread into the South on a semi-permanent basis. I think it might make the country ungovernable.
Ahmed joins us now. He's calling in from Raleigh in North Carolina. Hi, Ahmed.
Hey, I have a comment. I think the Iraqi government and the American coalition forces, I think they're making a big mistake by negotiating with this guy. The more they negotiate with this guy, the more he's going to seem powerful.
What would you have them do?
Just respond to him like in a, you know, one case at a time. If they fire, like, you know, an American, fire back on them and stop. Don't just keep this massive offense against him, because that's only just going to make him more powerful. And by negotiating with this guy, I think even by putting him in a political system, it appeals to the Iraqi people that the Americans and even the Iraqi government are afraid of this guy.
All right.
And this is giving him so much power. And I think, in my opinion, I think they just need to ignore him totally. And I think his movement would disappear once the Iraqi election comes up. Right now, if he goes in election, he's going to win. He's going to win, no doubt, because he's appealing to so many Iraqis. This is a big mistake.
Are you from Iraq yourself, Ahmed?
No.
Right. Interesting thought. Nir, ignore him and he'll go away. Is that possible?
That couldn't be more incorrect. If he's alienated, then he can act as a spoiler. He represents millions of people. These people view him as their voice. If you ignore him, you're ignoring them, and they'll only take arms against the system. I would think that the best solution is perhaps to co-opt him, or to attempt to, and to allow him to participate in the system. Therefore, he's not fighting against it, because the Americans are trying to establish a democracy, and perhaps the majority of Shias, view him as their voice, as their representative.
Juan, there is the prospect of elections next year. Is it possible that Muqtada and the people around him will participate in a political process and will become part of a legitimate quasi-democratic Iraq?
Well, I think there are lots of members of Muqtada's movement, and remember, it's not a movement with a great deal of discipline, who will run for office. I'd be very surprised if East Baghdad isn't represented by a raft of Sadrist representatives in parliament if there are free and open elections. Muqtada himself won't be easy to be drawn into that process. He has dictatorial tendencies. And from his point of view, remember, the American occupation of Iraq is illegitimate. He doesn't think they have any business being in his country. He wants them gone, and he views Alawi as a collaborator. I mean, from his point of view, now I'm not endorsing this, but from his point of view, he is Charles de Gaulle, and Alawi is General Pétain of the Vichy, and the Americans are like the Germans. I'm saying, I don't want to get myself in trouble, I'm not saying that this is true. I'm simply saying that this is his point of view on the matter. For that reason, it's very difficult to imagine a situation in which he would cooperate with that system. Now, he says that were the Americans to leave and were there to be free and open elections and a kind of democracy, that he would participate in it. But I frankly don't believe him. I don't think he believes in democracy. I don't think that's what he wants for Iraq. And I used to hope also that, you know, maybe there was a way of drawing him into parliamentary politics, getting him to trade horses. I've given up on that. I don't think it's going to be easy for him to be co-opted.
Nir, look forward for us for the next, let's say, 3 to 6 months. What role, assuming Muqtada survives this current Najaf standoff, what role do you see him playing? What role do you see him playing in the future of the country?
Well, we've seen him from the beginning vacillating. There's been a month where he supports the Iraqi government appointed by the Americans and supports the Americans and calls them our friends. And the next month he'll call them our enemies. So we can probably we'll continue seeing this wave of fighting and then the relaxation of the fighting. But I don't think the fighting will ever end until the occupation, which is the cause of the fighting, is over.
But there will also be, you seem to be suggesting a little earlier, a continuing conflict over who controls Najaf, particularly, of course, the holy places in Najaf. Is it the central government in Baghdad? Is it the people like Muqtada and those around him who are actually there on the ground?
Well, nobody wants the central government to control Najaf. Sistani and his supporters want the so-called moderate clerics to control Najaf, and Muqtada wants his supporters to control Najaf. And I think this conflict will continue, whether Muqtada is alive or not, because there are other clerics like Muqtada who think that their school of thought, this more Khomeiniist type of Shiism, deserves to control Najaf.
So quite apart then, Juan Cole, from the battle over whether or not the Americans should stay in Iraq, what kind of posture the military should have, it looks as if what we're seeing now is really a battle for control of the country, battle for control of the land, the towns, the cities, between the people in Baghdad, who, as you were saying, very largely have been put there by the Americans, and those like Muqtada al-Sadr and others who feel they have more legitimacy.
Well, Iraq has been in a revolutionary situation for a long time. In essence, what the Saddam government was, and the reason for which there are all those mass graves and it was so repressive, was that it faced a number of ongoing revolutions. The Shiites in the slums had their movement. The Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the al-Dawah Party, were all revolutionary movements that wanted to establish some form of Islamic state. And the Kurds wanted their autonomy. What the Americans have done is just set all that in play.
My thanks to Juan Cole, author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Politics, Culture and History of Shiite Islam, who joined us from the University of Michigan, and to Nir Rosen, freelance journalist who spent much of the past year covering the war in Iraq. Earlier this hour, we spoke to Amatzia Baram, senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and to Scott Baldov of Christian Science Monitor, who joined us from Baghdad. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Jen Matson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.